Hello and welcome to Season 4, Episode 1 of Unlimited Opinions. I'm Adam Bishop.
I'm Mark Bishop.
And we are starting on a new book, on a new season. We are reading On Politics by Alan Ryan, a book essentially summarizing the history of political thought. I believe he starts with Herodotus up until just about the modern day. I think this book was published in 2012, so it's not quite up to date. It's a decade behind, but still pretty modern in the terms of politics.
The funny thing is I would rather have something that was older. I was actually hesitating to choose this book because it was modern enough to be corrupted by politically correct thought. But it seems just from the introduction, it should be okay.
Yeah, this is actually the book that you picked for this season. And this season will probably, for the most part, be, unfortunately, over Zoom. It will not be our in-person recordings like we've been used to over the summer. I'm back up at college. Up here at Truman State. So we'll be recording these over Zoom for the most part. I think next week I'll be coming back into town. So we'll get a few in-person recordings in, but then for the majority of the season, we will be over Zoom. So a little bit of a different feel, I think, these Zoom meetings have. You can't interrupt me as much, which I'm sure will be very painful for you because this is the book that you picked, and you won't be able to interrupt me with your thoughts, very unfortunately.
Well, the listener is at a disadvantage because the listener loves when I interrupt you. And
yes,
disappointing. I'll have to wave at you, but a lot of times you're looking down at your notes or something, so I can't even get your attention. I've lost the moment.
It's very, very unfortunate. I'm sorry to hear that. So why did you pick this book? Why politics? Why did we decide on politics for this season?
Well, I don't know. I like the subject. I'm interested in it, and I haven't studied it in quite some time. As you may know, I have a degree in philosophy, but I also have a degree in political science way back when, from the Harvard on the Mississippi, University of Missouri, St. Louis.
I think that's the one and only time that anybody has ever called UMSL the Harvard on the Mississippi.
No, I've done it many times before. although now I would think that calling something the Harvard of anything would be an insult. The way the education system is now, I'd rather send my kids to UMSL than Harvard, even if the cost was the same.
Yes, but you were saying you have a degree in political science, and then I think you're going to continue on until I interrupted you.
I completely lost my train of thought.
I was asking why politics this season.
Yeah, and we've kind of done these surveys. I mean, the first survey was of Western philosophy. Then we did a survey of world mythology. Then we did a short. I think the summer season was kind of different because it was an interview format book, but also as a general exploration of themes in mythology. And so I thought, well, I'll do the political science, which is, like I said, it's interesting. And I haven't studied it in a while. And I think that it would be a productive thought because, you know, we're going to have a huge political crisis worldwide and also local in the next 5 years. So we thought we ought to be prepared for the oncoming onslaught of mayhem and anarchy. And then when we reform our communities into whatever we think is best at that time, we'll be prepared.
That's uplifting. Thank you for those lovely thoughts.
Well, you know, a lot of these themes I'm actually only half joking. But a lot of these themes are very topical now, as far as the relationship of individuals to society and relationship of individuals to the government and the government systems. What's the most effective and efficient way to form our society? There's a lot of challenging of the foundational principles of our society and our government. And I think unlike anything since really Great Depression era, when there's a big communist push, I mean, there've been other crises in American history, but there's so many people that don't value the republic that we have. It would be a good idea for us to kind of explore, what are the different options, and what is it really better to have a republic, and and you know, who gets to participate,
mm-hmm.
and who should participate. And those are, of course, dangerous questions nowadays. And of course, everybody, well, not everybody, there's a lot of people that fetishize democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's studied true democracies knows it's more dangerous than almost any other form of government. I'd rather be ruled by a king or a tyrant,
mm-hmm.
And the whims of one person rather than the whims of the mob, because one person at least would be fairly consistent.
Mm-hmm. And I think we'll get into that in a little bit later, because he touches on freedom and liberty and that sort of stuff here in the introduction. But I actually looked up just some background information about Allan Ryan, the author of this book, of course, just to figure out, you know, kind of what he's all about. He was born in 1940. He's a British philosopher, and he is still alive today at the age of 82.
Maybe we can have him on as a guest.
Well, you know, Anthony Kenny, I believe, is still alive, who was the author of our first book, The New History of Western Philosophy.
We could have a round table.
We could have a round table, as well as Bill Moyers is still around, and I assume Jake Jackson is still alive, but I don't think Jake Jackson has much of a public presence. But yeah, Moyers is still alive, and Kenny's still alive, so is Allan Ryan. So maybe one day we could have all of the authors of the books that we've read come to, you know, Missouri and talk with two podcast hosts who get next to no views.
Well, you know, if we paid them enough money, I bet you we'd come to Jefferson College and give us a symposium, assuming they're all in good health. I did look up him a little bit, and I noticed how old he was. Not that that's bad. That's actually great, because somebody that's been born 1970 or before is most likely a decent academic. Mm. After that, it's questionable. You know, you got to look into them, because anybody born in 1970 has been corrupted or has withstood the corruption of the imbeciles.
Well, there you go. And he does have a large
academic. Do you disagree?
No, I'm not disagreeing. I just want to make my points.
I feel like you're mocking me.
I'm not mocking you.
All right, move on.
So he was a professor of politics at the University of Oxford and the warden of New College there. He retired in 2015, and he has written several philosophical and political books. And the book that we are reading, this, you know, compendium of politics, was written in 2012. But I found like an old website of his, and it's just like title after title. Some of them are books, but all kinds of articles and stuff like that. So he seems to know his stuff, especially in like economic political theory and stuff like that. But he has a very large background in all kinds of academic writing. I guess you have nothing to say about that. That's good. That's good. Thank you for sharing.
Well, you know what we should have as our t-shirt theme or quote? Mm-hmm. For the fourth season, and we should have the famous the statue of the great philosopher. What's his first name? His last name is Faber. Knowledge is good, and he was it's at the beginning of Animal House. They pan over the campus and they pan on the statue, and the inscription is whatever his first name is. Faber. Knowledge is good.
That's a good quote. It's a great quote.
It's simplistically brilliant. I like it. But anyway, so I was just thinking of that. I don't know why. Yes. Why did I mention that?
Because your response to what I was saying was, that's good. And that,
oh,
that
there
got
you, go.
You in that.
Yeah, there you go. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for bringing this back.
You're welcome.
A little off tonight because it's a little bit later than our normal. Mm-hmm. We had to delay it because I'm taking dance classes. So,
yes, and I'm sure you're doing fantastic.
I'm the best dude in that class, man. I'm not kidding.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not a bad dancer.
Oh, well, there you go. That's impressive.
I'm not a good dancer, but I'm not a bad one.
Oh, there you go. So to move into the actual introduction here, it's kind of split up into two parts. The first part of this introduction is more so just like an overview of some of the big questions really that he wants to answer in this, and sort of an overview from the very beginning. And then he moves into, you know, how we think about politics. So he starts off, of course, at the beginning with, you know, Herodotus and this sort of comparison between the Persians and the Greeks. He says that Persia is the prototype to modern nation states. They gather taxes, they administer justice, they, you know, fielded armies. And then kind of from that, you get this kind of comparison to the Greeks, who had a fuller democracy and not just, you know, a head of state sort of controlling things, which is sort of the baseline of what all governments are. And he kind of compares the Athenians to the Romans and their ideas on freedom and citizenship, which I thought was very interesting and a neat way to start this book, because, you know, that's really the big question is, you know, what's the role of freedom? How much freedom should people have and how much role should they have in politics? Kind of what you were saying earlier. And he points out that the Athenians really had an unfiltered direct democracy. You know, each person gets one vote and they vote on just about everything. But the Romans had a different idea of freedom. And it was very carefully structured and controlled. And essentially, there were three parts to it. If you were free, you were one, not a slave. Two, you had a legal status. You could defend yourself in court. And three, you had certain political rights and duties, but they were graded to your financial status. So depending on how much money you made, you know, the different rights that you had, basically dependent on your wealth. And he goes on to say that as Rome grew, citizenship was extended to the captured cities, but without voting rights. So if you were captured by Rome, you became a citizen of Rome, but you couldn't vote in the Roman elections. And so this was very contrary to the Athenian idea that, you know, having voting rights is part of citizenship. You really can't separate the two. If you're a citizen, you have to have a vote.
Well, and practically speaking, it was brilliant on the Roman mm-hmm. part, because it brought those people in to the administration of the governance mm-hmm. Of the empire, and allowed them to expand peaceably mm-hmm. So effectively, because they weren't just subjugating people, they were incorporating them into the empire. And that's why it just kept expanding and you know, people bought into it, essentially. Mm-hmm.
Or bought off but this was very different than the freedom of the Athenians, because they said, you know, unvarnished political equality, equal rights in assembly, you know, no matter what, you know, you were, as long as you were a citizen, you had equal rights no matter what. And the Romans didn't see it that way. If you're a citizen, you know, certain people will have different rights depending on their status as a citizen. And so Alan Ryan kind of says that this leads to the unanswered question of how far we should try to follow the Athenians, kind of also what you were mentioning earlier about our celebration of democracy. You know, how much of that is really a good thing? You know, should we have just complete unfiltered democracy, or should we, you know, stick closer to the Romans with the citizenship rules, or, you know, what's the right balance in there? And of course, he says there's really no answer, but that's one of the things that a lot of these people, this book, try to answer, and none of them really quite get to the concrete answer.
Yeah, and he's talking about Athenian democracy, which is a particular flavor of Greek Greek governance. And I could be wrong about this, but I know there were dozens of city-states, and each one of them had a constitution. And we don't have all of them. They haven't all survived. Not all mm-hmm. the city states survived, but not all the constitutions survived. But there are a whole bunch of different variations. So he's talking about the true democracy and the Athenian governance, which turned out to be really horrible. I mean, there's a famous battle, but I forget the name of it. But they had some setback, and so the assembly voted to execute the generals. And then they had to send the next day, they thought better of it, and they had to send another ship off to countermand that previous message, you know, because changed their minds. Because, I mean, just think of present day. If we all just had thumbs up or thumbs down on any major issue, oh, it'd be horrible. I mean, even I get swept up from time to time. And I mean, and so it's like, I'm kind of a person that doesn't like to go along with groups, and even I can go along with, you know, let's get them, you know, that type of thing. Anyways, that's kind of a side note
also relates back to the philosophy of season one, you know, with Socrates. That was, you know, the big story about Socrates is his trial and death, because he was voted to be put to death for, you know, corrupting the youth and not, you know, praying to the right gods, essentially. And so it's like, you know, it's the question of, you know, if you are part of a democracy and you say you believe in democracy this much, this is kind of Socrates's question. It's like, well, you know, they're saying that they can offer me a way out of the vote of the democracy, but is that really just? Can I, you know, if the people voted, you know, for this, you know, is there any justice in me getting out of this? Which was his big question. Of ultimately, he said no. If the people voted so, then it is so, and he died.
Right, and I wonder if anybody would have, if Plato or the successors would have really written about him if he hadn't made those decisions. You know, would those stories have carried through if he didn't just stick with his ideals? Maybe would those books have survived, or those writings survived? Because if he would have just said, "Yeah, let's skip town," you know, they may have just tore up everything because mm-hmm. then it's like all these preachers and stuff that we read about is like that they don't really believe in what they say they believe in. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I don't know why I went on that tangent, but yeah, I mean, you had this total democracy and that means that everybody gets to vote on all these issues and then they get whipped up and they make bad decisions a lot mm-hmm. of times. And the Roman structure was different too, because they had a separation of powers too, which mm-hmm. the Greeks generally didn't have. Certainly the Athenians didn't really. And so they had like the triumvirate, or they have a Senate, which would be more of a deliberative body, so to speak. And they had a different division of authorities,
yeah,
which is important, which people don't really understand. But I did like the very first line of the book, which I'm surprised he didn't mention. He says, this is the first line. This is a long book and a long time in the making, and coming in at 2.5 pounds in paperback. That is the truth. I mean, we're talking about, I think, 1,100 pages that we're going through in this one season.
Yeah, I believe it's 27 chapters. So I think 28 episodes, including this episode. So it'll be a decently lengthy season here. It'll be more similar to season one. And then from talking about, you know, the Athenians and the Romans, sort of the base work of these political questions, he goes into a discussion on organization, which I thought was interesting, kind of framing it like in the first question of, you know, how much of a role should money play in politics? Because, you know, when we're looking at the Athenians and we kind of, you know, tend to envy them, you know, oh, they have this direct vote. But then we look at our current society and sort of the role of money that plays in, you know, polling and advertisements and the mass media and stuff like that. But he has an interesting point here that I don't think I've ever really heard before. He says, political effectiveness is tied to organization. And one of the ways that we can organize is through money, of course. Of course, someone with a lot of money can organize things very well. But then, you know, we can also see that in just the regular person, you know, the less well off can be just as formidable by organizing in unions or by ethnic or religious backgrounds, etc. And so he then says that brings up another unanswered question. Can democracies protect the public at large, in quotes, you know, unorganized individuals from well-organized special interests? You know, the public at large, you know, this unorganized, you know, how well can we defend them against well-organized special interests, whether that's through money or through unions or whatever form of organization is out there?
And that's why you have to have something like the Bill of Rights, and you have to have those procedural protections. Because it's just like, you know, Hitler's party, and maybe I should mention Hitler because it's like the overwrought example everybody wants to use about bad societies, or let's just use the Soviet Union. You know, the early communists, you know, they had different splintered factions, and it was the ones that were most organized and, quite frankly, most brutal, that ended up taking control. I mean, very small. Certainly a very small percentage of the population. I mean, very, maybe 0.01% of the population was active in the Leninist operation, but they were so organized and so ruthless that they were able to, take control. And that is a good point that he makes. And I really like how he articulated it. But talking about a democracy, you know, like mm-hmm. present day, how do we protect the people that just want to go about their business? Yeah. You know, the unorganized people, which is always the massive majority of people in any society, just don't want to be bothered with the administration of the government. If they can go about their life and not be bothered with it, that's what they want generally. Yeah. And people always say, well, we need to have more people involved or more people voting. I don't want more people voting. I only want me voting. I want to be the only voter, because there's a good chance that other voter is going to cancel my vote. Why would I want mm-hmm. more voters? And the less voters, the more influence I have. But anyway, so
he gets into that exact question a little bit later. But to kind of go back,
who's authorized to make mm-hmm. the decisions? Who's authorized to vote?
Yeah, but to kind of go back to his distinction about, like, you know, money versus, you know, just general organization as a whole. I'd never heard that point before. Because right now, like. Yeah, because I mean, the big talking point is like, well, just those with money control everything. You know, if you have money, you can, you know, influence, elections, and you can do whatever you want. But, you know, you never really hear about the other types of organization. It's both uplifting and I think, you know, a little scary at points, because it's like, you know, we do have so many different groups out there and so many people vote just because, you know, well, I'm part of this group, so I should vote for the person that's part of the same group and stuff like that. And it's an interesting distinction there. You know, just any type of organization is effective, you know, not just money.
Well, money is not effective. I mean, you can throw the people throw millions and millions of dollars into these stupid campaigns for disorganized dummies, and they never get into power. You have to, the organization is the most important, but you need money for the organization. Mm-hmm. And that's why the left is so effective beyond their contribution to society and their amount of people, because they're organized and they buy what they call astroturfing. They buy the activists, all those people, you know, all the leaders, well, like the leaders of BLM, all the leaders of the left-wing protest groups are on payroll. They are paid for by wealthy special interests, but they are organized, and it gives the impression that there's more people that believe in them, and it intimidates people. That the mm-hmm. all the moderates or common sense or whatever you want to say, or the conservative Democrats have been forced out of the party because of the activists, and there's a lot of them on the payroll. I mean, they advertise for them. They say, you know, you want to make some money. That the you know, who has time to be protesting in front of the Supreme Court justices' houses days on end, all day and all night? I don't have time for that. I gotta work. I live in Missouri. These people are able to go from one state to the other, and so it's a combination of the two. And it's a great point. You need the organization, but you have to have the money to fund the organization. Mm-hmm. Labor unions needed to pool the resources so they can be effective too, because otherwise they're in the companies were very organized and they had money, because they would have a top-down structure where they bought off people that were like quasi police officers that would beat them to death, beat the union organizers and all that kind of stuff. And so they had a combination of the two, because they had really their own cities in some cases, but it's the definitely the combination of the two. The most important is the organization. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But you do need money to make the organization work and to flow. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He then goes in to talk about, you know, the elite versus the many, which was another really interesting point that he made, because he essentially says, you know, in any modern society, we have to come to terms with the fact that it's going to be a small group of people actually doing the governing. Really, it's not going to be an Athenian democracy where every single person votes on every single issue. It's going to be a small amount of people. And he says, well, how do we come to terms with that? You know, how do we make that a good system here? And he says, you know, the difference, you know, between, you know, an elite, you know, controlling everything and an elite actually, you know, working for the people is how they secure and retain the allegiance of the many. So he has this point here. I'm going to read from the book on page 14. He says, a totalitarian elite employs the secret police. A democratic elite employs pollsters and advertising agencies. Totalitarian elites, military juntas, and the like intend to hold power for life. Democratic elites allow themselves to be thrown out by the electorate. They may do their very best to cajole, persuade, or even bamboozle the voter, but they do not corrupt the courts, politicize the army, or send the secret police to the polling booth. He says that people may only get to choose between one elite and another, but open competition and free elections produce good government. He says this is the idea of modern freedom that differs from Athenian freedom. It's the private freedom of economic, literary, and religious concerns without having to answer to anyone else. He defines it almost as the freedom from the political sphere versus freedom in the political sphere. So he's kind of saying both at the same time, you know, the important thing is not just that you're free to participate in politics, but that you're free to not participate in politics and to not really care, and nobody can really make you say otherwise. And the other important point there is that the people that you elect aren't just there for life. You know, it's not necessarily important that everybody goes out and gets a vote. It's just important that there you are able to vote against somebody. That is the key issue here.
True. In a lot of totalitarian countries, you get a vote, but there's mm-hmm. only one on the ballot. But I underlined that part of that section that you read. Mm-hmm. Where it says, but they do not corrupt the courts, politicize the army, or send the secret police to the polling booth, talking about Democrats, small d Democrats, democracy. But you know what? Don't we see a lot of today corruption of the courts. I mean, is there anybody that doesn't think they're corrupted one way or the other? And speaking of somebody in the courts, politicizing the army, I think we're seeing that very effectively now with the retraining of the military for political correctness type issues, and sending the secret police to the polling booth. We haven't really done that yet, but we've had we're getting very close. And with the election changes, election law changes in 2020, where everybody could just mail in unverified ballots, what's the difference if you pat the ballots? It's very similar. So I mean, I think he's right though, because totalitarians do that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a real struggle today. You know, there's a lot of talk about restoring the norms of democracy or the republic or whatever. And boy, I think that's true, but I think people don't understand what that means.
Mm-hmm.
That means you get the politics out of the courts as much as you can, and have a rule of law, and you get all this. You have the army just focused on killing enemies, and everything else is secondary. But anyway, I thought that was a great discussion that he had in his book about the difference between people with totalitarian mindsets and people who believe in democracy and rule by the people. Ultimately, the people are supposed to be in charge of this, and that we have to have a system to effectuate that.
Mm-hmm. He says the freedom to participate in politics is important, but skeptics say that accountability matters more than mass participation. He says voting for any particular candidate matters less than the ability to vote against them. And he has another good set of quotes here that I want to read. He says that is the democratic aspect of liberal democracy, and it is impossible to achieve in the absence of the liberal freedoms. And what used to be called people's democracies, otherwise one-party communist states, or guided democracies, otherwise dictatorships, there is a very high level of participation, along with frequent opportunities to register enthusiasm for the ruling party and its policies. What there was not was the opportunity to canvass alternatives, to press for different policies or a different political leadership without risking imprisonment, torture, or death. Imperfect as liberal democracy is, it yields a measure of accountability to the public that the experience of the past 100 years suggests is indispensable to decent government and the rule of law. So again, kind of hammering home, you know, we hear all the time about we need more people to participate, we need more turnout, that sort of stuff. But really, that's not as important as just having the very ability to vote against them, right? It doesn't really need to be, you know, 100% of the population voting. It just needs to be an option for the public to vote against a candidate that they don't like.
Yeah, and if you talk to people who have not voted, if somebody tells you they're not going to vote, and they're friends, and they'll give you an honest answer. And you ask them, hey, why aren't you planning on voting? They'll say, you know, I just don't know who these people are. You know, and I think that every time that conversation comes up about somebody's either going to vote, they're thinking, I don't know if I'm going to vote. It's always because, well, that's not true. It's either they don't know, and they know they shouldn't make it be involved in the decision making process because they haven't been paying attention. Or secondly, they don't think it's worth. It's not going to make a difference. Maybe 50-50 on those, either because you're one of so many people, or because the whole system's corrupt, or whatever the case may be. But the fact that people who don't pay attention don't vote is a good thing, and nobody says that. I don't know why nobody says that. There's and especially with our educational system being so crappy. You know, you watch any of those man on the street interviews, it's depressing.
Yeah,
I was watching one today where the guy would ask questions, and when these people gave stupid answers, he'd say, "That's correct." He says, "Name three countries other than the United States: Connecticut, Texas, Idaho." That's correct. You know, it was so funny because he just deadpanned that they're correct. It was just ridiculously stupid questions. Name a four-sided object, and the guy couldn't do it. And it was, wow. I mean, of course, you know, granted, but I mean, I'm sure he's cherry picking, but you can't for anybody. And it was an adult. What adult doesn't know, you know, what a rectangle is, you know? And
Well, I mean, it goes back to that idea of, you know, freedom from politics, with you saying, you know, the voters who don't want to vote, you know, don't have to. And, you know, that's what you're saying. It's a good thing if you're not in tune to politics, then really you probably shouldn't be voting, because your vote isn't going to be an informed vote. And you have the freedom to do that. We don't need 100% voter turnout to have an election. We just need to have the ability for anyone to vote if they want to.
And the other group of people that I was mentioning is more dangerous and more corrosive. People that have lost faith in the entire system.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, if you have too many people that have lost faith, then it's revolutionary time. Because somebody's going to grab hold of that mantle and run with it. And there's going to be a lot of people with that person and behind that person. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's dangerous, because if that many people feel alienated by the system, something needs to change drastically. It's just dangerous times. And I think we're just getting closer and closer to that time where people of all political persuasions are like, yeah, I don't believe the system's set up for us, it used to be that it was only a left-wing talking point, super far left. Now it's far left and far right, and it's moving towards the center in both directions. And it's the dangerous times.
Go ahead. I was going to move on to his last topic in this first part of the introduction, where he talks about inclusiveness. He says that societies today that think of themselves as particularly democratic are democratic in that they have removed many previously acceptable grounds for claiming advantage, especially race, birth, and gender. So there's really nothing, like if you're sticking to the direct term democracy, there's nothing inherently more democratic. They're just, quote unquote, more inclusive. And he says that this type of democracy is very much at home with capitalism, because once the advantage claims are all gone, all that's left is one's contribution to society at large, which is easily measured in capitalism. Talking about this idea of inclusiveness in the modern sort of society and democracy and stuff like that, he goes on to talk about scientific advancements as well, kind of mentioning that, you know, where we're at now, these modern advances have allowed us to both help and kill many more people than ever before, for forcing politics into a global scale and introducing many new questions. That's where he ends sort of this first part of the introduction before going into his own thoughts sort of on the making of this book. But what are your sort of thoughts on the idea of inclusiveness and democracy, and, you know, why people are claiming that this is now more democratic?
Well, I think I am not an advocate of democracy. Mm-hmm. I'm an advocate of a democratic republic. And I think we've gone too far in changes to the Constitution for the purpose of having more direct elections, specifically with regard to the U.S. Senate. I think we need to appeal, what is it, the 19th Amendment?
Yeah, no. I think so. Well,
I can't remember.
19th might be women's right to vote.
Well, that too. No, I think I think that we needed if you look at how you're talking about money in politics, you look at how corrupt our current system is, in the form of corruption that we have, where we have nothing but multimillionaires in our Senate, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And people, I mean, I won't belabor the point. There's no accountability.
Mm-hmm.
For our U.S. senators, and I think that the selecting them by the state legislatures preserves the right of the states to administer the federal government as a party to that governance.
Mm-hmm. It
lost that by having the direct elections of senators, and he mentions talking about how, you know, doing things on an industrial scale, and now we're more connected than ever. And he's talking about global government, or alluding to it. And I think I think eventually we will get to some sort of more rational system that we have now. But I think it's all going to be based upon the nation state, similar to what we have with our original colonies as separate sovereigns, as they were first envisioned. But I think the United States first has to get a little bit back, more respect for that idea that each state is a separate sovereign in this union of separate sovereigns. But I think that same system is the only way to work for an international governance. I think it's great that more people are included as equals, obviously, goes without saying. But I think the push to have more direct involvement in mm-hmm. every decision is a huge mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that, like I see, because I represent a lot of public entities, I see in the municipal and the local political subdivisions of the state of Missouri that you really need to choose people. We do it through elections to make the mundane decisions, you know, and then those people really, what really happens is they hire an administrator and staff to actually run the system. Mm-hmm. So it's even further removed, but there's some accountability, but at some points, you know, you gotta defer to a different group of people or smaller, ever smaller group of people that has responsibilities over it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise it's anarchy and nothing gets done, or it changes on a whim. You have to have a certain consistency, but also have accountability. So I think I like everybody being involved in selecting our representatives
mm-hmm.
and going from there. But I really like the way the system was originally set up, where you have different levels of choices for the people that are going to end up running the government.
Mm-hmm.
And then the way we have it set up is great, or the way they set it up, where there's a natural tendency for them to fight with each other. The real problem in the modern system in the United States is that the elected representatives, the ones that are truly supposed to be most responsive to us, the House and the Senate, mostly the House, just refuse to do their job.
Yeah,
I mean, they just aren't doing their job. They're mm-hmm. passing laws and they're saying, here's the law. You know, about the environment, the EPA will run it, and they can make their own decisions about everything. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what we're doing.
So you're definitely sort of on the side of, you know, accountability is much more important than, you know, just mass participation. You know, everybody should have the ability to sort of have a say in things and that sort of stuff in terms of electing people, but it doesn't really matter so much their say in individual issues as much as their say in essentially removing elected officials if they don't like them.
Yeah, and the problem that we have now is that our country is so big, and we're so successful up to this point, and you know, it's always been the risk of in a democracy or representative democracy. Was it de Tocqueville that said, you know, it's a great system until the voters will realize they can vote to give themselves stuff. I don't know who, I think it might have said it originally in ancient Greece or Rome, but it's, you know, the bread and circuses thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have now. You see it in headline after headline after headline of everybody wanting a piece of the pie and nobody wanting to pay for it. I mean, I see it at a local level, state level, federal level. Everybody wants to have the hand in the cookie jar. Nobody wants to bake the cookies.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to buy the ingredients.
Yeah, the point about, you know, just the size of the United States is interesting, you know, to kind of go back to, you know, well, should we go back to more Athenian democracy? That sort of question is like, the thing with Athenian democracy and the reason it even remotely worked for them was Athens was much smaller than the United States is. You know, essentially everybody is accountable to the people around them because everybody would know everybody, at least to some extent, definitely within your community. But, you know, if even we're just looking at one state of the United States, if we're in Missouri, you know, the millions of people in St. Louis vote for something that only benefits them, then all the people in the surrounding counties can't really do anything about it. Because all the millions of people that had a direct vote to, you know, say, well, let's give the city of St. Louis just a bunch of money, and they're not going to be held accountable by the rest of the people if they just outnumber everybody else.
I agree with what you're saying in principle, but there's only about 350,000 people in St. Louis City.
Well, yes, there's
1.2 million in St. Louis County, and then Jefferson County's got 200 and something thousand. Yeah. I think St. Charles County might have a higher population than St. Louis City.
Mm-hmm.
But because there's a lot of businesses and sports teams in St. Louis City.
There's an exaggerated example, but you get the point. You know, if a large collection of people vote just to benefit them, then it's really hard for the rest of the people to do anything about it.
Yeah, that's right. And we have a huge problem right now with the lack of accountability in the federal level. I mean, you know, I've mentioned this before, you know, if I have a problem with the state government,
mm-hmm.
I can find my state rep. Now the one that just got he hasn't taken office, but he is elected our state rep, is Ken Waller. You've met Ken Waller before, and he's our state rep. So if he does something crazy, I can track down Ken. You know, and our state senator is Mary Elizabeth Coleman. She's coming into office. She lives up in Arnold. I can track her down too. So I have those two state reps. I probably can't get an audience with the governor without some, you know, some sort of influence or whatever. The Congress, and actually my state rep and state senator know who I am. Now, of course, I'm an attorney, so maybe that is a little bit different. I've always been involved in politics, but our congressman would know me from Adam, and our senators have never met me. And they can give a rat's ass about me. Mm-hmm. One of what, 9 million people or however many people in the state of Missouri. And so the big problem is the federal bureaucracy, which isn't even accountable to our elected representatives. And a huge problem that people don't grasp is the federalization of criminal justice. And they're doing it, some of it, they're doing it for the right reason, but you're talking about the federal government being involved in local criminal prosecutions. Well, everybody has a right to a jury, but if I commit a crime in Jefferson County, the jury pool is from Jefferson County. But if I get charged with a federal crime, even though it's in Jefferson County, the federal jury pool is from two or three counties north of St. Louis, all of St. Louis County, all of St. Charles County. I mean, you're talking about a couple million people all the way down to Cape are going to be people that are put on the jury panel. And so what they've been doing is federalizing criminal prosecutions in St. Louis City because they don't trust their St. Louis City jurors.
Interesting. Because
they acquit people. And they do that as a strategy. So they get these guys, on federal gun charges, which, you know, these are dangerous people. But if they would have charged him with the equivalent state charge, the range of punishment is about the same, or maybe you might even get more time depending on the circumstances in state court if you're convicted in a different county than St. Louis City. But instead of taking it to the St. Louis, you'll have a St. Louis City police investigation, St. Louis City police officers, but it all goes through federal court. Huh. You get a different jury. So you go from a majority black jury pool to a much minority black jury pool. You know, maybe they're 10%, maybe 20% of the jury pool. And so I don't mean to make it racial, but you're going to just not even talk about the racial side of it. Just the people in your community are going to be 10 or 20% of your jury pool now, because you've expanded the jury pool. And there's no accountability to the feds, the Department of Justice. And we're seeing that with the politicized prosecutions, and we're going to see worse of it. And once the Republicans get in, they're going to have to do the same thing to the other party, because it's going to have to be an arms race where everybody says, okay, we have to stop doing this, because it can't be one-sided. There can't be a system that's set up that only punishes one party. But I'm getting way far afield. Yeah. My main point is the accountability side of it. And as the country got larger, there are more and more people that are subject to one congressman. And depending on the size of the state, you know, there's when you have a direct election of a senator, they don't know me.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have the legislature picking the U.S. senator, I can go to Ken Waller and say, of course, everybody in the community can do that, but we can say, hey, Ken, you voted to appoint that knucklehead as senator. When he comes back up in 6 years, you better say no, because don't you agree he's a nut? And he, like Roy Blunt is selling us out like on a weekly basis, because he's so corrupt, and he's been corrupt for forever, but he's got the big money behind him and a name. And so he just chooses not to run for re-election. Now, if he was running for re-election and he had to get appointed by the legislature, I don't think they'd appoint him.
Interesting.
Because he is not conservative at all. What was the thing he just announced this week that was just so stupid? And I'm trying to think what it was. He was criticizing President Trump for having had classified documents in the recent Mar-a-Lago raid. Of course, there's just press reports that he had classified documents, and that's from leaked DOJ anonymous sources. So maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but there's Blunt. bitching about Trump. And so there's no accountability there. If if legislators were selecting the U.S. senator, then there's some accountability to the people where I can actually grab somebody that's involved in that decision making and say, hey, I really want you to vote against this person. And if they don't, I can run against them and I can knock them out. And then I can win a state rep seat. You know, I mean, any one of us has a legitimate shot at a state rep seat. If we're a good person, I'm not saying I'm a great person, but you know, any one of us in this community can win that race, theoretically. And anyway, so that's a big long rant.
That was a very long rant. I think we should move on to another topic
But I want to say one last thing.
Of course.
Because the country's gotten so big and because we've lost control over our U.S. senators, the corruption is out of control. There's no accountability. And so it doesn't matter if everybody votes. I'm really coming into that camp where it's like, why am I even voting one way or the other? Because it just doesn't matter. As Bill Murray said in the movie Meatballs. So that's when the best time to fight, when it just doesn't matter whether you win or lose, you just fight.
Beautiful.
Yes.
All right. I want to move into the second part of this introduction, moving away from sort of the summary of the big questions. He goes on, he talks about, you know, how we actually think about politics. And he says, political theory is very hard to define. It's not quite philosophy, not quite sociology, and it often involves, direct quote here, conversations across the centuries with their long dead predecessors as well as their contemporaries. So it's essentially what he's describing here is, you know, you're looking at, you know, the past, you're looking at their past ideas and comparing them to now, the ideas of the present and sort of, you know, trying to find out what's best. He says here, it's really impossible to do this without risking foisting our own views on the dead. So he says that On Politics was written with that in mind. He also says it was written not for the quote unquote academic intellectuals, but really for anyone interested, the, you know, the common intellectual, as he puts it, anyone who wants to read this book. It's not just for, you know, the academic political theorists. And he says that he attempted to not include his prejudices or dismiss speakers that he disagrees with. I'm going to read here from the book. He says, here I am sometimes sharp with thinkers whose greatness is indisputable, Plato and Marx to take two obvious examples. I am neither contemptuous nor dismissive of them. My sharpness is addressed only to their arguments about how we may best govern ourselves. Plato's metaphysical speculation is deep, rich, inexhaustibly interesting, but his remedy for political chaos is not. Marx's thoughts about economic analysis and his historical sociology are endlessly fascinating, but his evasiveness about just how one might manage a socialist economy is unforgivable. Mockery of either is unthinkable. Criticism is not. And I do like that attitude here in the book. You know, it's not just, you know, his favorite political thinkers throughout the times, but it's really the most important ones. And it's not just him, you know, dismissing those he doesn't like or criticizing just those he doesn't like. He's criticizing all of their ideas where they're worthy of criticism, but he's not mocking them. And so that's really where I guess more so you come in. You will be mocking all of the political ideas that you do not like.
I was thinking the exact same thing. Yeah. You will be respectful and maybe critical. I will mock them.
Yes.
I really loved how he wrote this introduction and how he articulated it. And I like this line where he said, when he's talking about reading, you know, these the thoughts of long dead people, where he said, we're eavesdropping in the Elysian fields. I just thought that was just beautiful, as if we're walking among them. When we read their books and their thoughts, translated into English, of course, and we're kind of eavesdropping on their conversations with their contemporaries that they put in writing, and we need to have that perspective that they were a product of their times, but they have something to say to us as well, because there's some universal, you know, human nature hasn't really changed, I don't think, over all these years, and so but our technology certainly has changed, and the number of us have, which we have to take into account. But I think if I mock anything, I'll mock what their views are, but I wouldn't necessarily mock them. I mean, I'm just some small town lawyer in Missouri. And these are, you know, we're going to be reading about some of the greatest political thinkers in the history of the world.
And he goes on to talk about, you know, what's sort of the big question then, what are we thinking about? And the first that he kind of says, you know, are modern democracies really democracies or something else? Because every modern society really likes to define themselves as a democracy, except for a few. It says nearly all modern societies call themselves democratic, but are all vastly different to one another and to ancient democracy as well. It says that raising such questions is not to condemn modern politics, as life is much better today than ever before. But he does say here, but we should at least wonder what we are praising when we praise democracy, and when we pledge our commitment to liberty and justice for all, we should wonder whether these are the liberty and justice of the American founders, let alone the liberty and justice that Cicero or Marsilius said we could achieve only when the common good was pursued by selfless rulers. So that's one of the big things he's trying to do with this book, is really, you know, define a lot of the big terms. You know, what are we looking at when we say democracy today? How does that relate to democracy, you know, 2000 years ago? What is the true democracy? You know, what is the true meaning of the words that we're saying when we're talking about these things? And I think that's very, very important to be educated on the topics that you're actually talking about, and not just saying some things because you think they sound good, which I think is a problem with a lot of political conversations today.
Yeah, and I tend to get caught up in the structure, the political structure, mm-hmm. and the process. And there's a lot to be said for the political culture. Mm-hmm. You know, the culture in the United States, of course, is slavery, but the political culture and the amount of knowledge and intellect available to the framers of the Constitution, I don't know if it has occurred before or since in any country, anywhere, or any time in the world, that those thinkers were able to form a constitution and a government. I mean, mm-hmm. they were so well read, yeah. almost all self-taught. They all knew political theory forwards and backwards. They debated the big issues, but also debated them with practical considerations. And so what I'm saying is that there was a culture there of intellectual thought that I think is a danger. Mm-hmm. If you don't have, and when you expand the vote to everybody, and you actively have everybody participate in the decisions, but they don't spend any time studying it, mm-hmm. I think that you get back to the Athenian problem. Yeah. You have the whims of the mob, and mm-hmm. I don't want to be judged by the mob, that's for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. So then he kind of goes on and he kind of concludes here, you know, what is this book actually about? You know, what are we going to talk about in this book? And he says, the bottom line is that the book is about the various answers to how can human beings best govern themselves and all the questions that come with that. And he says, you know, the deeper questions are only followed so far as they illuminate ideas and how we should best govern ourselves. So he kind of points out Plato here. You know, we're going to talk about Plato. We're not going to look at all of Plato's philosophy. We're going to look at some of it a good deal, just to explain how he answers the question, how do we best govern ourselves? So that's kind of going to be the process here as we read this book and, of course, relay these thoughts to all of the, you know, millions of listeners out there. You know, it's going to be not, you know, 100% in depth of each singular person, but it is going to be in depth of how they answer how we should best govern ourselves.
And you know, the funny thing is I think Plato's writings on politics are the biggest BS that he wrote. You know, I mean, I thought his idea, well, he even mentions how Plato and Marx, I don't know if he didn't say he didn't respect them, but he has mm-hmm. a lot of disagreements with them and the views they espoused. And I think that's right on, man. And I love he put in here, he even admitted he's a cynic. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a man of my own heart. I always want an author to be cynical and be critical and of themselves.
Yeah.
And he's clearly in the introduction telling us he's trying. He's mm-hmm. trying to play it straight. He knows he can't play it straight perfectly, but he's going to try really hard. And I mm-hmm. was just encouraged by the whole introduction.
Yeah.
I look forward to reading this because, you know, there's always going to be a person's point of view.
Yeah.
Book. I mean, it's 1100 something pages or whatever, but I think he's right. The way to look at it, the way to study it.
Mm-hmm.
And how we go about this whole process. I think I'm really excited about.
Well, I also liked, you know, you would expect in an introduction like this, especially with someone, you know, who's a professor at Oxford, you'd expect, well, I've done this and this and this. Here's a book I've wrote. Here's an academic paper I've wrote. Here's all the titles I've held. We get like brief snippets of, you know, who Alan Ryan is, you know, says, you know, I read this, you know, important political work when I was young and that kind of, you know, inspired me, but you don't get the full list of, you know, here's my entire, you know, resume. I'm just this good. And this is why you should trust me. It's more so I'm being critical of these things, you know, and I'm going to try my best to just give them a fair look. I'm going to be cynical. You know, I'm examining, you know, how I'm writing this book. And I just, I really like that approach to things. It's not, you know, I'm Alan Ryan and I'm writing this book. It's, you know, I'm writing this book because I want to give an interesting look at the history of politics.
Yeah. Real humility.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
False humility. He clearly is smarter than he is letting on.
Yeah. And
I always appreciate that as well.
Well, the final sentence of the introduction I really liked. He says, speaking about the book, "Its success will be measured by the readers who pick up Plato's Republic, Hobbes's Leviathan, Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, and find themselves engrossed rather than baffled. And even when they are baffled, are happy to go on reading, interrogating, and arguing with their authors for themselves." And I like that approach. You know, it's not just, you know, I am the definitive writer now because I have this big old history book. This is an introduction. This is an overview. We're going to look at these things. And it's not just an interview because, you know, I say that these authors are, you know, the best source of all time. You know, it's an overview because I want you to look at them yourselves and find your own thoughts about them. You know, criticize these authors and find what you like, find what you don't like, discuss them in depth. Don't just read them because they are great and they have to be great and are indisputably, you know, the best out there.
Yep. And if he was trying to write an introduction to get me interested in his book, me personally, like if he tried to do, he couldn't have done a better job.
Yeah.
I'm sold. So hopefully I won't be disappointed.
I think this is the one and only book that you have texted me after you were done reading a section and told me that you really liked it. Like that you were really excited to keep reading. I don't think that's ever happened in the, what, like 80 episodes we've done now at this point. I think it's over 80. I don't know how many it is. We're getting up there, but it's a lot.
Yes.
Yes, there we go. The wonderful thoughts of Mark Bishop.
I have two gears, mm-hmm. rant and one word answers. One word responses.
Yeah, I know.
Don't encourage me. Every time I have a one word, you always encourage me to go on a rant. I can go on a rant.
I know you can go on a rant. Do you have any other thoughts before we go in and end this episode here?
I think I've said enough. I have, we talk about unlimited opinions. I have unlimited rants with regard to political thought.
Yeah.
I think this could be my rant season.
This will be, yeah, I was about to say this will be a very rant heavy season. We'll see how many words I can get in here, but it'll be a lot of you, for better or for worse.
For better. So what do you think about the introduction?
I really liked it. I mean, I kind of said all my thoughts there. I especially like his humility towards the subject and his like dedication to fairness. That's what I really like to see. You know, I was kind of in the same boat as you when we were trying to figure out a book to read. You know, it was almost too modern, I guess. You know, it's a modern book, and you see, I mean, it'll be very, very hard to find any modern book about politics that's not just designed to spin one way or the other. I'm not talking about, you know, the author's influence kind of creeps in. I mean, the book itself is designed to show one side of the story. I think that's a lot of what you get these days. Right. But I was very impressed by the introduction. I think it'll be a good read.
Good. Excellent. Hopefully we won't be disappointed.
Yes.
If we are, we'll be really angry.
You will be very angry. We'll see how I'll be. But the first chapter is about Herodotus. So that'll be something to look forward to next time.
I don't think I know anything about Herodotus.
I don't think I do either.
I might have known something at one point, but whatever I knew, I forgot. So you can learn about Herodotus. Yeah.
Starting right from the ancient Greeks. So just about the very beginning.
I wonder if he has left off. I haven't looked at all the chapters. Has he left off like Eastern thought? I haven't seen. Or is he pretty much focused on, Western political philosophy?
That is a good question.
I assume there's a lot of political thought with regard to the, well, at least the administrative state in China, I would think, mm-hmm. Ancient texts. But I don't know if they had, I don't know. I don't know if they've had, you know, books that are well known that talk about political philosophy. Well, yeah. there's Sun Tzu, The Art of War, but that's a little bit different. But it can be applied to politics. So what did I say?
You said Sun Tzu.
Sun Tzu?
Sun Tzu, I think. That's how I've always pronounced it. But yeah, I'm looking through like just the chapter names here. And it seems to be mostly focused on Western thought.
Good.
But I think at the very end, once we get into, you know, democracy in the modern world, global peace and the human future, I think we get more of the global aspect of things, you know, looking at stuff from other places. But at least really in the beginning.
Yeah, I'm really light in the comparative political philosophy.
You know, yeah, so. I know very little as well. All right, well, this has been season 4, episode 1 of Unlimited Opinions. I've been Adam Bishop.
I'm still Mark Bishop.
And you can, of course, follow us on Twitter at ULMTDOpinions. That's ULMTDOpinions. Amused by me saying the Twitter handle there.
No, I'm just trying to figure out. I think we should have another T-shirt contest. We got to figure out what the contest is and what the quote would be.
Absolutely, we have to combine season 3 and season 4 as well, because we didn't do one last season.
Well, season 3 was like a one-off. It's kind of a different kind of a shortened season, different style of book. I don't know. I think that's just kind of a unique one. Maybe our summer seasons, you know. 50 years from now, we'll have a whole catalog of summer seasons. Although I'll probably be 102. I don't think I'm gonna live that.
That'd be impressive if you were still doing this at 102. I don't know what kind of thoughts you would have at that point.
I might be half robot. I don't know.
We'll be the first podcast to have a half robot host. All right.